Grab your sleeping bag, get some change for the canteen, get ready for a weenie roast. It's diner camp, but don't bring any sunscreen. It hasn't been invented yet, actually. Around these parts, you burn, and then you peel. It's the diner for Friday, July 21st. Welcome.
Excuse me, that's my stool that you're sitting on. That's all my stuff spread out there. Right. No, it's okay. I got up and I went to use the facilities, and that's okay. No, that's okay. No harm, no foul. Good. Well, good luck getting a seat.
Man, I'm crowded in here today. I've never seen it like this on a Friday afternoon. I wonder what the occasion is. And it's all couples. It's all 30 and 40-something mom and dads. I'm guessing they're mom and dads. There's no children anywhere, but the couples all seem to have that air of relief you get when you're not looking after your children or worrying whether or not they're juggling knives or playing doctor or straightening paper clips and pushing them into electrical outlets. Huh, I wonder what they all did with the kids. Hope it was legal. None of that duct taping them to the chair and feeding them NyQuil now. Ew. There's a mom and dad from the upper mom and dad demographic in the back booth making out like they haven't had the chance to do that in some time. Can't take your eyes away from it. But I have to. Hi, folks. Welcome to the diner, the busy, crowded diner. I'm James Lilac, sitting here at my usual, now reasserted, place at the long boomerang pattern for Micah Counter. I at the diner out on Old Highway 23, about 18 and a half minutes from wherever you happen to be right now. And that's including the traffic, which is steady and heavy, coming down Old Highway 23 from the north. Well, let's see what's on the menu board today, shall we? And there's nothing on the menu board. That's peculiar. There was something just a while ago. S'more burgers. Yes, S-apostrophe more burgers. I have no idea what it was. I didn't even want to ask. Because it was either one of two things. Either it was a divot of charred meat between a graham cracker bun with chocolate and melted marshmallow on it, the very thought of which makes you want to bolt your gorge, or it was a hamburger where the condiments in the enclosures were cunningly made up to resemble s'mores. But that's not going to work. If your eyes say candy, your mouth had best not answer meat. So they didn't sell one. They're probably all heaped out in back in the dumpster, where the raccoons are having sport with them as we speak. I haven't had a s'more this year. Have not had my annual s'more. And I'm almost hesitant to do so, because I fear that the things have changed in the s'moreverse. If I went to Restoration Hardware, I would probably find a kit for making s'mores, and it would be done up with all kinds of old-timey graphics promising retro treats, and there would be tungsten rods within that you would use to hold the things together. Well, in my day, you got a stick. You went out in the woods, you found a good stick, you pierced the marshmallow, and there you had it. But I can't possibly imagine modern parents being comfortable with the idea of kids actually taking a stick off the forest floor. Where has it been? What fox with his awful caked feet trod over it? What wee crawling beastie with his innumerable little pseudo-appendages? What microscopic bacteria did they deposit on that thing that you're now sticking into the... I mean, what are you putting in your mouth? A forest stick? But s'mores were beloved back then, of course. Kids love s'mores. We had Jet Puffed Marshmallow. That was the regional brand that we had. And that was very modern, I suppose, in the 1960s. The idea that they had fed gallons of marshmallow fluid into an actual jet engine and out the end streamed an infinite quantities of perfectly formed little marshmallows. They've been puffed by jets. You had your breakfast cereal that was shot from guns and your marshmallows that were puffed by jets, and then you would use them with graham crackers and Hershey bars. Interestingly enough, both of those things are named after people. The graham cracker was named after, the invention of Mr. Graham. What was his first name? I want to say Chester, because that sounds right. Chester Graham, who had his theory of interminable mastication. And then, of course, Mr. Hershey, who was a pioneer in the chocolate industry, a chocolate baron. a plutocrat nonpareil when it came to assembling the cocoa trust that rules to this day. Anyway, I'm babbling, aren't I? I should play a piece of music here. Let's see what's on the jukebox. What have they added since last I was here? Dun-da-da. Ooh, B12. You loved it as a vitamin, you'll trust it as a diner patron.
Nellie was a city gal, more than nine-tenths pure, till a country guy came riding by on a 10-cent trolley tour. His eyes were mean, his heart was black,
and this interurban tramp
beguiled poor Nell and took her back to his nearby nudist camp. His cohorts looked her over in a picturesque ravine,
from orchestra and balcony to second mezzanine,
and then and there elected her to be their nudist queen. Oh, she's so sweet when she appears, the corn's all eyes instead of ears. Taxi drivers strip their gears for Nellie, the nudist queen. Her point of view is rather quaint, she holds her subjects in restraint. Though love is blind, the neighbors ain't, says Nellie, the nudist queen. Among the trees with birds and bees, she flutters and she flitters. She rambles and she gambles and she toddles and she titters. When Nell goes by, all nature thrills. Mountaineers desert their stills. There's more than gold in them thar hills. There's Nellie, the nudist queen. Now her overhead expense, to say the least, is very small. She never needs a tailor, there's no laundry bill at all. And her meals are always splendid in her out-of-doors menage. A dinner for a dollar, and of course no cover charge. When you see a nudist wedding, as we did the other day, you can watch the groom's expression when they give the bride away. You can tell by her reaction if the model's old or new. You can always tell the best man at a nudist wedding too. Now some creditors came calling at her clearing in the hills and asked to see a statement that would justify her bills. When they viewed her liabilities, the atmosphere was tense. But when she showed her assets, boy, her assets were immense. So we're going back to nature to go native minus clothes, with a great big tin of aspirin and menthol for our nose. Though only God can make a tree, as famous poets tell, it seems if he can make a tree, we ought to make our Nell. A blind man came the other day, threw his pencils right away, took off his specs and said, I'll say to Nellie, the nudist queen. A boy of five came out to chat, she gave his cheeks a playful pat. The kid cried, Mama, buy me that, Nellie, the nudist queen. Like ancient Greeks, the human freaks about the fields go naked. There's good clean fun out in the sun, that is if you can take it. Oh, she's a woodland nymph at play, front and rear, she's décolleté. She's got class with a capital K, Nellie the nudist queen.
You know, there used to be a nudist camp up Highway 23. It's true. It was in the 40s, and it was called Johnson's Haven, which seems a little redundant for a nudist camp, founded by, I don't know, Old Man Johnson, Chester Johnson. And I've seen the brochures, and no amount of bleach can drive those memories from my synapses. As if the idea of hanging around with some pale, scabby, pendulous Minnesotans wasn't bad enough, they forgot to factor in the mosquitoes, so that after 2 days, everybody was just a big, walking, red welt. It closed after one season. And then it reopened as a children's camp. And from what I understand, there was some confusion for a couple of years, some unfortunate overlap. It took a while for the brochures to work their way out of the system, I guess. And so you would have people showing up with nothing more than a towel and a hopeful smile and be rather, you know, in the mood for some naturalism, and then horrified to find small, unnaturalist tots running around. But eventually they stopped coming, and the camp prospered and thrived. Still there now, Camp Lake Lalac, home of the Lake Lalac Backpackers, I believe. And they're probably out there now having canoe races or jumping off inner tubes or getting ready for the bonfire. If I went out back with the binoculars tonight, I could probably see them having a weenie roast and a s'more fest over the bonfire, but But people tend to frown upon unattached males standing behind the restaurant with binoculars looking at children's camp, so I don't think I'll be doing that, and for good reason. I have my own memories of camp, you know, and they get me through. Of course. That's why there are no kids in here. That's why everybody looks like a parent. They've all been dropping off their kids at Camp Lake Lilac. Of course. I wonder what it's like. I wonder if it's like the camp I went to. I went to camp for 7 years. My parents dropped me off in 1966 and picked me up in 73. No, seriously. I went to White Earth Lutheran Camp every summer for 7 years. White Earth Lutheran Camp in scenic, festive Waubun, Minnesota, right next to the White Lake, or the White Earth Indian Reservation, right next to White Earth Lake, and surrounded for miles and miles and miles by nothing but black earth. I don't know where quite they got the name, but we figured the Indians knew something we didn't. I'd like to say that I have hundreds of warm memories that I clutched to my bosom of the summers that I spent there, but I have about 5 or 6 memories, and that does not include John Larson calling everyone into the latrine to show the unbelievable size of the bowel movement he'd just exuded. It was a typical camp for its era, the 60s and 70s, built long ago. Musty old barracks, 2 wings with a counselor in between, the walls full of graffiti. But this being a Lutheran camp, of course, it was very nice, tidy graffiti with good penmanship expressing love for Jesus. In the morning, you would get up and go down to the mess hall, have a prayer, have a song, all very happy, and eat army surplus food. These were before the days when you could go to Costco and get a 47-gallon drum of mayonnaise. In those days, you had to get everything from army surplus, apparently. And I never could understand the concept of army surplus. Why did they have surplus? Of all the people who you'd think would know exactly how many people they have to feed, it would be the army. But no, they made too much. Or maybe there was something wrong with it. Maybe this pancake mix did not meet military specs for pancakes, and that's why they were giving it to us. But tasted fine. Army surplus pancakes, army surplus butter, army surplus syrup. And then you'd go off to your day of playing tetherball and going to the swimming hole and taking long walks in the woods and becoming infested with ticks, which would be tweezed out and burnt out at the end of the day, excuse me, by the camp physician, who, I recall, was impressed by me because I had watched many Marcus Welby MD shows and had memorized the names of many diseases that nobody ever got except on Marcus Welby. I still remember one of them because of the sheer beauty, the euphony of the name of the disease. Ankylosing spondylitis. Oh. Say it twice and it's almost like praying. I was sitting there having ticks tweezed out and telling her that I'd seen this show about ankylosing spondylitis, and she'd never heard of it, but she agreed that didn't sound too good. The memories that do stick, unfortunately, have probably become embellished over the years until they bear faint resemblance to what actually happened. You take, for example, my conversation with a padre about the end of the world. This being 68, 69 or so, you know, it was part of that demographic that grew up fairly certain we'd be incinerated in a nuclear holocaust. But when? That was the question, wasn't it? And I think I'd read some apocalyptic tract, or you know, so I wanted to quiz the padre on it, because if anybody knew, he'd know. So I asked him, you know, is it true that the end of the world is going to come and it's all predicted and these are the end times and that the Bible says something about the eagle fighting the bear? Because, you know, we're the eagle and they're the bear. I mean, and he gave me a look which was not reassuring. I wanted the fatherly padre smile, the pat on the head, you know, the little tweak of the cheek, you run along, kid, and have a great time and don't worry your head about these things. But he got solemn and quiet and said, "We know not the day, nor the time, nor the place, nor the city, nor the megatonnage, nor the blast radius." I mean, and essentially just kind of left it at that. I walked away feeling no better than when I'd begun the conversation. Like he knew something. Like he didn't want to spoil our summer somehow. Well, the other memory is from the same summer, actually, and it had to do with a girl on whom I had a large crush. I should explain, this was a co-educational Lutheran camp, which is not, by all means, unusual for things Lutheranistic.
I could digress for a second. I went down to the church basement the other day, the church to which we belong now, and they were having some summer theater camp there. Most of the participants were female teenage girls, and they were dressed as teenage girls are wont to be dressed nowadays, tight shorts that said juicy on the butt, and just as tight shirts. And I'm looking at this and thinking, this is indistinguishable from a harem in 1001 Arabian Nights. That's even worse. I mean, I've seen illustrations from that book, and, you know, the women of the harem wore pillowy pants that came up to their navels, and veils. That had nothing on a Lutheran church basement, for heaven's sakes. Well, it wasn't as immodest at White Earth Lutheran Camp, but there were girls. And I was a red-blooded American boy of 11 or something. So I developed a crush on a young lady who had long, dark hair. And the reason that she really impressed me, besides the long, dark hair, was that she looked very much like a character on Hawaii Five-O I'd seen a couple of weeks before, a female protagonist who crossed swords with McGarrett. And you could tell there was something between her and McGarrett. It was an adversarial relationship, but there was a charge to it. You know, they respected each other, but it was more than that. So she looked like her. That actress also showed up later on an episode of Star Trek, which just completely sealed the deal for me. So how exactly do I impress this young lass? Well, I could wait until canteen time and share some of my lemon heads with her. Yes, that was the candy of the season, I believe. It was an unusual time in candy technology. We were on the cusp of the era in which we are today, in which you have innumerable variations on sucrose and dextrose and maltrose and the rest of them all wrapped up in a shiny carapace of carnauba wax. That was still to come. We had passed the glory day of the candy bar, which, to be frank, you know, had pretty much exhausted what it was going to do with the genre. Chocolate over nougat. Nougat over chocolate. Yeah. There were sweet tarts. Sweet tarts were new, but, you know, the Lutherans were going to stand back on that one and let that one play out. See how that turned out exactly. They're sweet and they're tart at the same time? Really? You sure they won't, like, explode when they get into you, like matter and antimatter or something? I mean, they're sweet and they're tart. Make up your mind. It's a little too Manichaean here. So I could share some of my candy with her, the Lemonhead stuff, or the Mike and Ikes, or the other Atomic Blasters, you know, all varieties from the fine candy factories of Ferrara Pan Just Born, or I could impress her at the dance. There was going to be a dance at the end of the week, held down at the tennis court. Now, how could I exactly impress her? Well, not by dancing, obviously. I'd have to get her out on the floor first, and then I could impress her with my twitching about. But no, I have to get her attention, and I'd spend all week mightily striving to get her attention to no avail. Well, naturally, I came up with what any 11-year-old boy would come up with. I decided to coat myself in fake blood. I had brought a tube of fake blood to camp. You never know when that'll be useful. And before I went down to the dance, I put some on my face, and I put some on my hands, and what the hell, I put it on my knees and legs, and staggered toward the dance. I don't know what I was thinking. Either that she would believe I'd been off fighting wolves or something, or that I had been set upon by bullies and needed comforting. I mean, you never know. You never know. Just you figure you're going to see where the fake blood takes you. So I walk towards the dance, and as I come under the lights, the first person I see is the Padre, the aforementioned pastor to whom I'd posed the question about the end of the world. And his face was absolutely stricken. "My son," he said, "what happened to you?" Oh, God, my son. And I had to sort of smile. "Nothing, nothing at all. It's just fake blood. You know, I sort of wiped it off. It's fake." And he got a look of absolute disgust on his face that I had so cruelly traduced his compassion. I expected him to whip around and say, "You know what? I know the time. I know the date. I know the city. I got the memo. I'm in the loop. But I'm not going to tell you." And then Dean, the cool counselor, who was a teen or 20, you never know, came over and confiscated my fake blood, and that was the end of it. So I wiped it off and went to the dance, which consisted, of course, of the girl standing on one side and the boy standing on the other side and everybody not dancing to whatever stupid music they were playing at the time. You Hang On, Sloopy, or the 9,000th time we'd heard Snoopy versus the Red Baron or something like that. All that pop, sugary music from the late 1960s that nobody liked the Archies. Yeah, a couple of girls liked the Archies, and a couple of boys pretended they did, but no, seriously, all the boys were waiting for Steppenwolf to happen, and this stuff was just nonsense. So I just sat there and did not enjoy the music, but I worked up my courage, I worked up my nerve, and I finally walked over. And I walked right straight up to her, Miss Hawaii 50-1968, and I asked her to dance. And she turned me down flat. I think that was the only time she talked to me at camp. At all. See, but why I don't particularly trust this memory is when I recall it, I see her standing there, and she's a four-foot version of that actress from Hawaii 5-0. It's the damnedest thing. Anyway. You know, come to think of it, I wonder if the jukebox has any of those tunes. Let me see if it has anything from that wonderful era of bubblegum pop that was forced down us at the Lutheran camp. Oh, yes, indeed. But first, a word from our sponsor.
This program is brought to you by the makers of Popsicle, Fudgicle, and Creamsicle, those delicious frozen confections on a stick. Now I have a swell surprise for you. The famous winner of the typical American boy contest has now become Popsicle Pete. And here's a message from him.
Hello, everybody. I sure am glad to meet you. And boy, am I glad I was picked to be the typical American boy, because now I'm Popsicle Pete. I always wanted to be on the radio, and now I have a chance to tell you about some wonderful presents you can get free. Do you want to see them? Hundreds of them. You get them just for saving bags from Nifty Popsicle, Fudgicle, and Creamsicle. Some gifts, even better than Christmas. You can get a wristwatch, a movie camera, table tennis, a wallet, a doll. Gee, lots of gifts. Just save the bags from Popsicle, Creamsicle, and Fudgicle on a handy stick. Boy, do they taste good.
Wholesome, too, and nourishing. Made fresh every day of the finest ingredients. The biggest 5 cents worth anywhere.
And say, kids, get the free illustrated Popsicle gift list at your ice cream store. A free coupon comes with it, worth 10 bags.
Up on the balcony.
Cam Fong is Chinmo, James MacArthur is Danny, Zulu is Kono, or vice versa, I don't know, and then that other guy in the last season, Al something. Fish Eye Lens of the Jet Aircraft.
Filmed entirely on location in Hawaii, in case you thought they mocked up that mountain on a studio backlot. How I loved Hawaii 5-0, and not just for the theme, but the theme had a lot to do with it. Let's take a look at something else that was going on, coincidentally, in pop culture, shall we? While you had the Ventures in Hawaii 5-0 on one hand, you had the bubblegum rock that they made us dance to at church camp on the other, like this.
Come on, everybody.
Yeah, Captain Groovy and his bubblegum army. That's who you want to send into Fallujah. I wonder if he's any relation to the captain of the Ride, Captain, Ride song. By the time that one came around in 1970 or something, I was older and convinced that the song was really deep, man. It spoke to my generation. No, it's impossible, of course. That was the Navy. So maybe Captain Groovy, after his failure to lead the people to the Promised Land with the Bubblegum Army, switched branches and went into the Navy, and that explains that. Ride, Captain, ride upon your mystery ship. Be amazed at the friends you have here on this trip. Yeah, that's what I want in a captain. I want a guy who walks around in a state of perpetual agogedness because he's got so many buddies with him. Deese! Paul, how you doing? John, Harvey, Bruce, all right! And of course, none of these idiots are doing ship things that need to be done, like swabbing the forecastle or trimming the mainsail. But what do you expect? These guys all signed up for a voyage with a captain who considers the act of sailing a ship to be riding. Man. Ugh. Well, I guess it's just a sign that people in the 60s and 70s weren't exactly up on the details of military technology when they spun their little stories. And then there's that other captain, the one who turned down Brandy, if you remember that song. Oh, Brandy, you're a fine girl. What a good wife you would be, but my life, my love, and my lady is the sea. You know, buddy, you're probably in port for a couple of days. You don't have to marry her. All right? I'm starting to think that Brandy wasn't that good of a looker, okay? He's just letting her down gently. Oh, I'd love to date you, but unfortunately, I'm married to a large aquatic body. That's right. So much so that when I go around the horn to another ocean, I actually feel like I'm cheating on the sea to which I am married. I don't understand. I can understand loving the sea, but I mean, it's your place of work. It's like saying, I can't date you because I'm married to the office, specifically the 32nd story of the IDS building. And there's no way to get out of that lease. Not even the Pope will let me out of that lease. Anyway, I seem to have gotten away from the camp theme, haven't I? And that was a pity because I have two more riveting tales, which, now that I think about it, all come from the same year, which was not a good one for me. It appears to be a year fraught with peril and anxiety, and in the end, a strange sort of humiliation that I still to this day regard as not entirely, what's the word? Well, it's obvious that I deserve to be humiliated. I was the newbie at camp. But still, they were wrong. I did see something. Now, I'm not talking about ghost stories. I'm not talking about any tale you tell around the campfire that inevitably ends with a hook hand hanging from the handle of a car. No, I'm talking about something else. It's something intrinsic to the camp experience. But you know what? It's a very painful memory, and maybe I just don't feel like reliving it today. Looks like a kid from camp has made his way into the diner. I can tell because he has a Lake Ladak Backpackers t-shirt on. He's going over to the counter. He's waving at the waitress, standing on tiptoe. Very cute. And he's asking her something.
Excuse me, could I have a snipe sandwich?
He wants a snipe sandwich. Oh, that's too good. Oh, that's just what I was talking about. My first year at camp, they sent me out in the middle of the night to get a snipe. They gave me a plastic bag and a stick, and I was supposed to go out there in the dark and bang on the side of the bag until a snipe ran in and then bring it back to them. And I was out there all alone in the dark, and it was actually fairly frightening. And at one point, I was convinced that something ran past me, and I thought that was a snipe, whatever a snipe may be. And I scurried back to the camp, and everyone was waiting. Everyone was in their bunk looking down at me like birds from an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Bated breath, silence, and the leader, John Larson, he of the large bowel movement, asked if I'd gotten a snipe, and I said, no, but I think I saw one, and they all exploded into laughter, and I felt humiliated, and I've never forgotten what it was like to be the first guy and have everyone turn around you. And now here's this poor little kid. They've sent him here to get a snipe sandwich, the modern version, apparently, of a snipe hunt. Oh, but there's not a parent here who didn't go to camp and have them
do that to them, too. Every man jack in this joint has suffered the humiliation at the hands of the John Larsons of the world. This poor kid.
Hey, everybody. The kid here. He wants a snipe sandwich.
I know, it's cruel, but think how happy he'll be next year when it's his turn to be the John Larson of the world and send somebody out into the dark with a bag. Life is like camp, isn't it? You're full of blood, the girls turn you down, and it's over too soon. But then you get to go home, whatever that means. In any case, thanks for dropping by, folks. I'm James Lonix. This has been The Diner for Friday, July 21st. We'll see you next week.
Shit.